Radio Buddhist Youth Association. Good afternoon, everyone. You are listening to the sound of universal compassion. Please enjoy.
Greetings and welcome to the program, whether you've been with us before or if this is the first time you've tuned in. We are investigating the mind training practices that originated with the great Indian pandit Atisha, and since then have come down to us through various interpretations and commentaries by subsequent realized masters. The particular text we're following is Mind Training Like the Rays of the Sun by Namkar Pal, which is a commentary on the 7 points of mind training expounded and made popular by Geshe Chikawa. I guess if you're a historian of sorts, you may be interested in this background, but in truth the whole teaching is aimed at transforming our negative and ignorant mind into the radiant consciousness of the Buddha. Along the way, of course, we will be learning how to make this and future lives more and more beneficial and happy. But that is merely incidental. Focusing on that as our aim would be the mistake of doing what the mind training explicitly tells us not to do, practicing for a reward. If you've been with us for the last few programs, you will know that we've been discussing the disadvantages of just that. Last time, we even saw some scientific research reported by Dr. Jeremy Dean that suggests that when we act for a reward, we often pollute the joy of the action, thus losing the intrinsic motivation for it. Dr. Dean uses as an example getting paid for something we enjoy for its own sake. He says play becomes work when we are paid, and often we associate work with something that is dull, tedious, and painful. He writes, the person who previously enjoyed painting pictures, weaving baskets, playing the cello, or even writing blog posts, suddenly finds the task tedious once money has become involved. This, of course, doesn't always happen. When I was working as an editor and magazine designer, I continually rejoiced that I could work at something I enjoyed doing so much. However, when something we enjoy entails pay and therefore obligations, it can become less enjoyable and more tiresome. In any case, as far as the mind training is concerned, the maxim is, give up all hope of reward. Although we are encouraged to give up hope for rewards in just about every context, Trungpa Rinpoche, in his commentary on the 7 points of mind training, says something about abandoning rewards in mind training in particular. He says, giving up hope has to do with thinking that we are gaining some nice results from mind training. We are able to be more kind and compassionate to others, less selfish and so forth. But then, we may hold in the back of our mind that if we are good, people will be nice in return. We have some expectation of being rewarded for being a good person and having a good heart. Or maybe we think about good results later on. For example, I will get something important out of this at some point. Of course, it's not the case that we won't. Or we could expect, as I become a better practitioner, others will know me for being so. They will. There's a definite consequence of practice that ripens as a result. But in the context of mind training, we give up all hope for results. But now, before we go on with Namkar Pal and mind training like the rays of the sun, let's set a motivation for the program today. As usual, let's make that motivation bodhicitta, the intention to gain enlightenment so we can best help all other beings in any way they need, but especially to attain their own enlightenment. That is the greatest motivation we can have, because the object, all other beings, is so vast. If our motivation is only for ourselves and our own well-being, we're only thinking of one person, and the one most dear to us at that. Now, this is not at all altruistic and can lead to more pride, ego-grasping, and so on. But if our concern is for all beings, can you see how our self-interest and self-cherishing shrinks? This concern also helps free us from the sneaky thought that we might get some good karma, some merit or reward from developing a good motivation. As Trungpa Rinpoche says, due to cause and effect, that will just happen. But if our motivation is polluted in some way, the good karma may ripen in an ugly situation that prevents us from experiencing its full benefits. So let's set a bodhicitta motivation without any sense of personal reward. Thank you. Now the next maxim in mind training, like the rays of the sun, is avoid poisonous food. Namkar Pal says, generally good food nourishes the body, but if it is poisoned, it can cause death. Similarly, the state of enlightenment springs from listening, contemplation, and so forth. But if they are polluted by misconceptions, such as the eight worldly concerns and selfish thoughts of I and mine, they can take the life of liberation and omniscience. So please don't let whatever merit you acquire be sullied by them. So basically, the Dharma is like healthy, nourishing food for our spiritual practice. And if we practice it properly, we can become increasingly spiritually healthy. Optimum spiritual health is, of course, the aim of the Buddhist teachings. Traditionally, the teachings tell us that we are to regard ourselves as sick, and if we want to get better, we have to take refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. This is because the Buddha is likened to the doctor who prescribes the medicine. The Dharma is the medicine the Buddha doctor prescribes, and the highly realized Sangha are like nurses. They show us how to take the medicine and do whatever else helps us to attain health. What makes us sick are karma and afflictive emotions, and especially the grasping at and cherishing of the appearance of an inherently existing I. Once we grasp at this idea of an inherent and independent I as real, we attach to whatever appears good or helpful to the I and resist anything that appears as a threat or unpleasant to the I. We are indifferent to all the rest as basically irrelevant. From this model of behavior, we of course are on the constant hunt for pleasure while always trying to avoid pain, even the slightest discomfort. We're very happy to gain possessions, reputation, friends, and so on, while if we suffer a loss, even a comparatively minor one, we complain mightily and start on the road to depression. Don't we all want fame, worldwide if possible, but even if it is only in our local community, and don't we do anything to avoid disgrace? Who doesn't love praise, even if it is misguided, and hate being blamed, even if one is at fault? These, gain and loss, pleasure and pain, fame and disgrace, praise and blame, are the eight worldly concerns. The worldly person is attached to the four, gain, pleasure, fame and praise, while being averse to the other four, loss, pain, disgrace and blame. The spiritual practitioner is training not to be influenced either way by these eight. For instance, we are trying to receive praise or blame with the same unaffected mind, paying more attention to the truth of the situation rather than our own egoistic reactions. Like the story I've often told in these programs of the renowned monk with many followers who had one very ardent female admirer intent on sharing her bed with him. But because he was a monk, he steadfastly refused all her advances. In the end, she became angry with him, and when she had a baby by another man, she came to one of his teachings and in front of a large crowd dumped the baby in his lap. "Here, this is yours," she said loudly and stomped off. Naturally, many followers, shocked and disillusioned at this breakage of the celibacy vow, immediately got up and left. However, the monk just cradled the baby in his arms and calmly continued teaching to those who remained. When the teaching came to an end, he took the child home and cared for it as best he could. Some days later, the woman recognized that she had done something very foolish and wrong and went to the monk, apologized, and asked for her baby back. With the same calm, kindly demeanor, the monk handed over the baby with his blessings. It mattered not a jot to him that his reputation might have been ruined by her behavior, or that he would be exonerated by her admission of the truth. Unconcerned with the eight worldly dharmas, he did the best in the situation that he could, and this is how Namkar Pal advises that a person wanting to practice mind training acts. For he says that if any of the eight worldly dharmas are mixed up in our practice of the Buddha's teachings, it's like poisonous food. Instead of making us more healthy, our dharma practice just strengthens the afflictive emotions and leads us further and further into the samsaric experience. In other words, It just makes us more and more sick, like poisonous food, and it can lead to a spiritual death. This is what Chogyam Trungpa writes in his book, Training the Mind and Cultivating Loving Kindness, when he's commenting about the slogan. If the practice of egolessness begins to become just another way of building up your ego, building your ego by way of giving up your ego, it is like eating poisonous food. It will not take effect. In fact, rather than providing an internally awakened state of mind, it will provide you with death because you are holding on to your ego. So, if your reason for sitting or doing post-meditation practice or any other kind of practice is self-improvement, it is like eating poisonous food. If I sit properly with the greatest discipline and exertion, then I will become the best meditator of all. That is a poisonous attitude. He goes on, this is a very powerful slogan for us. It means that whatever we do with our practice, if that practice is connected with our personal achievement, which is called spiritual materialism, or the individual glory that we are on the right and others are in the wrong, and we would like to conquer their wrongness or evil because we're on the side of God and so forth, that kind of BS or cow dung is regarded as eating poisonous food. Such food may be presented to us beautifully and nicely, but when we begin to eat it, it stinks. He mentions spiritual materialism, a term he himself coined because he saw a danger in the way that we approach spirituality. In his well-known book of the same name, he talks about the egoless state being the attainment of Buddhahood, and then goes on, the process of transforming the material of mind from expressions of ego's ambition into expressions of basic sanity and enlightenment through the practice of meditation, this might be said to be the true spiritual path. We've come here to learn about spirituality. I trust the genuine quality of the search, but we must question its nature. The problem is that ego can convert anything to its own use, even spirituality. Ego is constantly attempting to acquire and apply the teachings of spirituality for its own benefit. The teachings are treated as an external thing, external to me, a philosophy which we try to imitate. We do not actually want to identify with or become the teachings. So if our teacher speaks of renunciation of ego, we attempt to mimic renunciation of ego. We go through the motions, make the appropriate gestures, but we really do not want to sacrifice any part of our way of life. We become skillful actors, and while playing deaf and dumb to the real meaning of the teachings, we find some comfort in pretending to follow the path. Whenever we begin to feel any discrepancy or conflict between our actions and the teachings, we immediately interpret the situation in such a way that the conflict is smoothed over. The interpretation is ego in the role of spiritual advisor. The situation is like that of a country where church and state are separate. If the policy of the state is foreign to the teachings of the church, then the automatic reaction of the king is to go to the head of the church, his spiritual advisor, and ask his blessing. The head of the church then works out some justification and gives the policy his blessing under the pretense that the king is the protector of the faith. In an individual's mind, it works out very neatly that way, ego being both king and head of the church. This rationalization of the spiritual path and one's actions must be cut through if true spirituality is to be realized. However, such rationalizing is not easy to deal with because everything is seen through the filter of ego's philosophy and logic, making all appear neat, precise, and very logical. We attempt to find a self-justifying answer for every question. In order to reassure ourselves, we work to fit into our intellectual scheme every aspect of our lives which might be confusing. And our effort is so serious and solemn, so straightforward and sincere, that it's difficult to be suspicious of it. We always trust the integrity of our spiritual advisor. It does not matter what we use to achieve self-justification. The wisdom of sacred books, diagrams or charts, mathematical calculations, esoteric formulae, fundamentalist religion, depth psychology, or any other mechanism. Whenever we begin to evaluate, deciding that we should do or not do this or that, then we have already associated our practice or our knowledge with categories, one pitted against the other, and that is spiritual materialism, the false spirituality of our spiritual advisor. Whenever we have a dualistic notion, such as, I am doing this because I want to achieve a particular state of consciousness, a particular state of being, then automatically we separate ourselves from the reality of what we are. If we ask ourselves, what is wrong with evaluating, with taking sides? The answer is that when we formulate a secondary judgment, I should be doing this and I should avoid doing that, then we have achieved a level of complication which takes us a long way from the basic simplicity of what we are. The simplicity of meditation means just experiencing the ape instinct of ego. If anything more than this is laid onto our psychology, then it becomes a very heavy, thick mask, a suit of armor. It is important to see that the main point of any spiritual practice is to step out of the bureaucracy of ego. This means stepping out of ego's constant desire for a higher, more spiritual, more transcendental version of knowledge, religion, virtue, judgment, or comfort, or whatever it is that the particular ego is seeking. One must step out of spiritual materialism. If we do not step out of spiritual materialism, if in fact we practice it, then we may eventually find ourselves possessed of a huge collection of spiritual powers. We may feel these spiritual collections to be very precious. We've studied so much. We may have studied Western philosophy or Oriental philosophy, practiced yoga, or perhaps have studied under dozens of great masters. We have achieved and we have learned. We believe that we have accumulated a hoard of knowledge. And yet, having gone through all this, there is still something to give up. It is extremely mysterious. How could this happen? Impossible. But, unfortunately, it is so. Our vast collections of knowledge and experience are just part of ego's display, part of the grandiose quality of ego. We display them to the world, and in doing so, reassure ourselves that we exist, safe and secure, as spiritual people. Chogyam Trungpa then goes on to say that he realizes most of those spiritual practitioners he speaks to genuinely want to learn and develop, but he warns about knowledge being something to be collected like a rare antique. The Buddhist teacher Judy Leaf also discusses the slogan, don't eat poisonous food, in her commentary of the 7 points of mind training. She writes, the image of poisonous food suggests an experience that is seemingly nourishing, but in fact can kill you. In terms of slogan practice, this image refers in particular to the poison of ego fixation and its power to transform the nutritious food of loving kindness practice into poison. In Buddhism, there is a great respect for the power of self-centeredness to co-opt even the most magnanimous or sublime experience for its own self-aggrandizement. The idea of ego is not so much a thing as a habit of using whatever experience arises to solidify and prop up our feeling of a solid and separate identity. It is literally a form of ingesting experience to fatten our own self-absorption. The realm of spirituality is an especially seductive form of poisonous food. In the great spiritual traditions, there are yummy practices, exotic rituals, beautiful liturgies, profound texts. We can attend workshops galore, hang out with brilliant teachers, even become teachers ourselves. We can gather students and get VIP treatment, and at the same time still feel totally virtuous and not caught, like others, in trivial concerns. With each helping of this meal, we build up our feeling of being special, important, popular, compassionate, and profound. We can even become wealthy. As we build up our spiritual institutions, we can feed an even larger ego, a collective ego. We can turn the pure and nourishing food of genuine spirituality and practice into the poisonous food of power-mongering, sectarianism, unthinking allegiance to dogma, and groupthink. We can create cozy cocoons and wallow in our smugness and superiority. Eating poisonous food feeds the ego and poisons our spiritual freshness and innocence. Instead of dissolving our estrangement from ourselves, each other, and the environment in which we live, Eating such poisonous food hardens our differences and heightens our confusion. By eating poisonous food, instead of lessening our self-deception, we are fattening it up. And that is Judy Leaf on tricycle.org. Eating poisonous food feeds the ego and poisons our spiritual freshness and innocence, she writes. Another article I came across that resonates with this mentions, perhaps surprisingly, the meditation practice of loving-kindness in a traditional Jewish synagogue. The article is written as a blog on the Huffington Post by Rabbi Alan Lurie and is titled "The Allure of Narcissistic Spirituality." While the article is, of course, written from a Jewish point of view, it has much to say about our mind-training slogan, "Don't eat poisonous food." And just a note, when Rabbi Lurie speaks of the divine or God, perhaps we can think in terms of Buddha nature. And this is what he writes. "Several months ago, my wife and I attended a prayer service at a synagogue that is well known for its spiritual and spirited approach. As we entered, the rabbi was leading a meditation. 'Close your eyes and breathe in the peace of Shabbat, the Sabbath,' she said. 'And on the out-breath, imagine that you are sending healing love to all beings.' We passed a man who appeared to be deep in meditation. His eyes were closed, and through a slightly open smile, he slowly breathed in and out. As we moved to our seat, I accidentally stepped on his toe. He quickly turned towards me. His smile vanished, and he angrily hissed, 'Hey, watch it, buddy!' In the irony of a person being angry at a stranger for accidentally interrupting his meditation about universal, unconditional love, this man demonstrated the disturbing, alluring, and all too common phenomena of spiritual narcissism. To understand spiritual narcissism, we must first understand the word spirituality. My acting definition is the experience of a transformative connection. In other words, spirituality is experienced. It is not a concept or construct. It transforms us. It changes how we act, think, and feel in all environments. And it is a connection, a profound contact with something and someone outside of ourselves. All three of these components are needed in order for spirituality to occur. But the most essential is that it be a connection between a person and the divine, or between one person and another. Spiritual practices are designed to facilitate these connections and begin with the knowledge that we have two selves, an ego self and a true self. The ego self is built on our strategy for ensuring that we are physically safe, stemming from our interpretation of the experiences of our lives, primarily our childhood, in which we determined what was required in order to survive. The ego self may need to impress, dominate, or control, and sees others as either threats or tools. There's nothing inherently wrong with the ego self. It is a necessary structure put in place so that we can survive in physical reality. But it's not who we really are, and we cannot make a spiritual connection from it. Our true self, however, which is often referred to as our soul, contains the very purpose that we incarnated and is in constant connection with spirit, consciousness, creation, God. It sees others as fellow souls with equally needed purposes and has compassion for the suffering that comes from the ego self's attachment to things. Spiritual practices help us to loosen the grip of the ego self and to connect to the true self so that we can live purposefully, be of service, and participate in love. The central biblical injunction to love your neighbor as yourself is usually interpreted to mean that we must learn to love others with the assumption that we already love ourselves. Literally translated, though, this line actually reads, "As you will, in the future tense, love your fellow in the same way that you love yourself." In other words, we will love another to the extent and in the way that we love ourselves. If you are harsh with yourself, you will be harsh with others. If you cannot forgive yourself, you cannot forgive others. In this way, this line is not a commandment, but is a statement of fact. The truth is that most of us do not love ourselves very well, and consequently, we hurt others. This is why spiritual practices so often seek to teach us how to love ourselves, so that we can better love others. real love naturally flows in two directions. Spiritual practices become narcissistic, though, when the ego self hijacks the process and assumes that it is the object of self-love, becoming enamored of looking in the mirror and claiming that its reflection is the true self. Then we lose our way, forgetting that the purpose of learning to love ourselves is to become more open, kind, and effective in interactions with others. And instead of opening our hearts with humility and compassion, we assume a position of superiority, exactly what the ego desires for its safety. Spiritual narcissism sees self-love as the end goal. Spirituality to the ego self is an object of attainment, much like fame, wealth, an expensive car, and a sexy body. Spiritual narcissism creates the pretense of holiness as an ego strategy to mask insecurity, receive approval, or avoid struggle and growth. "I am a spiritual person," it proclaims proudly. "I travel to alternate realities, see auras, heal chakras, predict the future, talk to spirits, commune with angels, manipulate energies, meditate for 3 hours a day, harness the powers of the universe to attract success. The truth is that I'm more evolved than you." Deep spirituality makes us more sensitive to the feelings of others, encouraging an open stance of courage where we can drop our protective shields and accept the vulnerability to be seen as we are. Narcissistic sensitivity, however, is focused solely on the subtle nuances of one's own internality and resists looking at hard, uncomfortable truths that may upset the self-image. One who is narcissistically sensitive is easily offended by the coarseness of others, seeks to make his environment change to align with the contours of his needs, and gets angry or offended when this does not happen. At a 7-day spiritual silent meditation retreat that I recently attended, devoted to nourishing equanimity, attendees routinely wrote messages to the retreat leaders with complaints about others. One attendee complained that 2 days of progress was ruined by another attendee who sent a note with the words, "I love you." And another complained about someone who was walking too loudly on the leaves outdoors. And the leaders publicly scolded an individual who broke the rules by reading a book in public. In Jewish tradition, embarrassing someone in public is considered a very destructive and violent act and is strictly forbidden. While complaining about others and shaming a rule breaker at an event intended to teach equanimity is, like the story in the beginning of this blog, ironic, it teaches an important warning. The desire to control others in order to create a perfect environment that nurtures our sensitivities is a calling card of spiritual narcissism. And there we must say farewell, for time is up. Thanks for joining the program today, and I hope you'll tune in again next week. Please dedicate any positive potential we've generated to gaining enlightenment to benefit all beings everywhere. Thank you and goodbye.
Planet FM